Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Deepak Chopra, who reads from and discusses his new novel, Buddha, The Story of Enlightenment, published by Harper San Francisco. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. We are so delighted to have Deepak Chopra with us tonight. Deepak has revolutionized common wisdom about the crucial connection between body, mind, spirit, and healing. A best-selling author for decades, he's been perched on the New York Times for weeks and weeks. His books have sold over 20 million copies and have been translated into 35 languages. Now with Buddha, A Story of Enlightenment, Deepak presents his insights on the inspiring life of one of the world's most important figures, the Buddha. It is a gripping narrative from a gifted storyteller. Deepak is the founder of the Chopra Center, which will soon, the ground is being broken now for a location here in Colorado in Westminster. He is also the founder of the Alliance for a New Humanity, whose mission is to facilitate the strengthening and emergence of an actively caring humanity. His weekly show, entitled Wellness Radio, airs on Sirius Satellite Radio, and his frequent work with PBS is one of the most highly viewed and successful fundraisers in the history of the network. No one's changing the channel there when Deepak's on. A much sought-after public speaker, we are so very glad that he has returned to the Tattered Cover. Please welcome Deepak Chopra.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's great to be back here. I think this is one of my favorite stores, and I've always tried to make it part of my tour, so thank you for having me. Jeff, are you here? Jeff Hart? See that man in the back? Okay. His name is Jeff Hart, and he is a teacher of meditation and trained by the center, but he runs many other programs as well. Right now, he's also helping me create a local chapter for the Alliance for a New Humanity, which is a non-profit, and the goal is to create a critical mass of peace consciousness in the world. You all have a little brochure about it. If you register, then you'll find a way to connect with other people who are doing the same thing. I think in across the world now, people are very interested in three things. One is their own personal transformation. The second is some way to make a difference in the world. And the third is to hang out with others who are doing the same thing. So if you're interested in doing that, then register with anhglobal.org. You have it. And get in touch with Jeff also. Okay, so how many people know the story of the Buddha? And how many people have no idea what the story is? Okay. Well, lots of people ask me why I wrote this book, and I have to tell you that for several reasons. One is that I lived with these stories as a child. I'd heard these stories from my grandmother, from my mother, from aunts and uncles. They were part of our growing up. And there were many versions of the story, of course. And it was a fascinating story for me growing up. I didn't think about writing it till I lost my parents. And I was actually doing the cremation of my father. And I had taken the ashes up in the Himalayas. And I happened to visit a temple where apparently, our family had been taking the ashes for a long time. So when I went there, as was part of our tradition, the family priest brought a register, and in the register was an entry by my father when he had brought the ashes of his parents. And then he turned the page, and there was another entry by my grandfather when he had brought the ashes of his parents. And then he turned the page and there was an entry by my grandfather, great-grandfather. And he kept turning the pages. And I said, how far can you go back? And because the languages started to change, you know, English, Hindi, Urdu, Persian. And he said, how far do you want me to go back? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we've been doing this since the time of Buddha and after that since the time of Alexander the Great, 300-something B.C. They've been keeping these records. So, you know, I thought to myself, I had two parents. I had four grandparents. I had eight great-grandparents. You go back 50 generations, only 50 generations, and that's a few billion people that have lived, loved, and had to be in a certain mood. otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Right? Now, because if one of them, one of these few billion were missing, as I said, or wasn't in a certain mood on a certain night or day, I wouldn't be here. So is this all an accident? Is the fact that we exist a pure coincidence? Just an accident, a random event? Well, if it is, that's amazing. And if it isn't, that's amazing. And there are two schools of thought, by the way, on this. Okay. One that says everything since the moment of Big Bang has been an accident. And another that says that actually, if you go deep enough, then there are no accidents. Everything is synchronized with everything else. Everything interdependently co-arises, which was a Buddhist insight about 2,500 years ago. And that's what a number of scientists are saying. They say, we cannot see the big picture because we only have bits and pieces of sensory experience. With our bits and pieces of our sensory experience, we can't see the total picture. But if we could see it, and we can, not through thought, but by going beyond thought, then we would see that everything is synchronized, is in harmony, or in Buddha's word, interdependently co-arises. So as I was, you know, doing the rituals with my father's ashes, these were the thoughts that were going on in my mind, and the priest who was doing the ritual, he suddenly interrupted my reverie, and he said, one day your children are going to bring your ashes here. I said, actually, I'd planned to bury them at Oakley Golf Club in Brookline, Massachusetts, because I had a hole-in-one there at the par three. But now that you say so, maybe I'll do it here. And so at that moment, he made me write a note to my children when they would come there one day with my ashes. And I can honestly say that at that moment, I felt non-local, if you know what the word means. Non-local. Non-local means having no location in space or time. It's a word that's been introduced recently in our scientific literature, that there's a domain of existence which is non-local, where everything is inseparably one, where space-time, energy, information, and matter all become a field of possibilities. And that non-local domain is consciousness in its ground state. Consciousness behind our thoughts is also the consciousness behind the intelligent activity of the whole universe. Another Buddhist insight. So I said, I've got to write the story of this man. What must have he gone through to find these amazing, brilliant insights, which I'll share with you in a few minutes. But for those of you who don't know the story, he was born a prince into obviously a royal family. And when he was born, the astrologers predicted that either he would rule the world, he would become a great emperor, or he would leave everything and become a monk. And so his father was a little distressed. Obviously, he had great ambitions for his son. He named him Siddhartha. Siddhartha means one whose wishes come true, one whose every wish is granted. And so when there was a prediction that the Siddhartha might actually become a monk, that distressed the king. And he asked the court priests, he said, how can I prevent him from being a monk? And they said, surround him with pleasure. Give him everything that the material world has to offer. Affluence, abundance, every sensual, sexual experience the person can possibly have. Delight his senses. And prevent him from seeing suffering. So the king actually turned out all the people who were old, who were invalid, who were crippled, and he created a city for them outside the ramparts of the palace walls. In the palace, the young boy was just surrounded by sheer materialistic expressions of ecstatic pleasure. There were three boys who were growing up together. Siddhartha the prince, a cousin of his name was Devadatta, who actually had a great dislike for Siddhartha because Siddhartha was gentle, even though he was very proficient in the martial arts, in archery, in astronomy, in mathematics. He was extremely good in wrestling, the things that princes were taught. But he had a gentle, compassionate side to him as well. And Devadatta was very jealous of him and also had ambitions for the throne. And the third boy that was growing up with them together was a son of the man who looked after the horses in the stable. And he was what is called a half-caste. He was, they didn't know, you know, his family origins, and he wasn't part of the princely class. And so they discouraged him from playing with the other two, but since they didn't have too many playmates, the three actually did start to get together. And Chana, the stable boy, became Siddhartha's best friend. And they would play games and they would go and practice archery and wrestling and fencing and all of that. And Devadatta too. When he was a teenager, then according to one of the versions, and as I said, I heard so many stories when I was growing up, but according to one of the versions, his father created a pleasure palace for him to initiate him into the sexual experience. And there was a young girl there, about 12, 13, he was 16 maybe. And so young Siddhartha had a crush on her. And in a fit of rage, Devadatta, who was very jealous, one night he murdered and raped this young girl and threw her into a river. And when she disappeared, Siddhartha didn't know what had happened. One of the people at the pleasure palace said, well, you know, you gave her an emerald. She's probably run away with the emerald and she's going to sell it. Which, of course, also made him extremely distressed and unhappy. And he had feelings for this woman. So he asked Chana, his best friend, let's go outside the palace walls and see if we can find her. And so these two teenagers, they went out, and for the first time, Siddhartha saw what real life was all about. He saw people who were very poor. He saw people who were extremely old, people who were crippled. And finally, he saw some corpses that were being prepared for a cremation. And he asked Channa, he said, does everyone get old? And Channa said, yes. He says, does everyone get sick? And Channa said, yes. At some point, they do. And then he said, does everyone die? And Channa said, yes. He said, will I die? And Channa said, of course. And that started his existential conundrums and his confusion and his anguish, and became the seed of his spiritual journey. The first part of the book deals with all of that, deals with his childhood, the dynamics between him and his cousin, the dynamics between him and the stable boy, the boy from the stables, the dynamics among the three of them, and the relationship between Channa and his father, which is also a dysfunctional relationship, because father had great ambitions for his son and the son seemed not so interested. So it's all in the form of a story, but as you see, it's a story that is almost everyone's story. There's no one in their life who doesn't have these questions at some point. Why do we suffer? What is the meaning of our existence? What happens to us after we die? Do we have a soul? Does God exist? And if she does she care about us? So we all have these questions. And we all also, despite sometimes getting everything that we want, there's still a deep sense of desperation and anxiety. It's everyone's story. Siddhartha's story. But the second part is not everyone's story. Siddhartha decided one day to leave. And in fact, to become a monk. And so he convinced his best friend, Channa, to take him outside, leave him in the forest. And I won't go into the details because you'll see, but through a series of accidents, people come to believe that Siddhartha has died, that he's been killed. And you'll see when you read the book. And in a sense, that's metaphorical too, because the prince dies and the monk is born. And his name is now Gautama, which was a common name, but also a name at that time that was common amongst monks. And now Siddhartha, who's now Gautama, has started to go on a spiritual journey. And he does all the things that people do who are seekers. Gautama is not interested in theology. He's not interested in finding the so-called truth through belief or faith. He's more interested in finding the truth through his own experience. And that struck a chord with me also, that part of the story, because I've always believed that belief is a cover-up for insecurity. We only believe in things we are not quite sure of. Okay? So I don't have to have you believe in electricity. You can see the light bulb and you know how it works. I don't have to have you believe in gravity or any of the forces of nature. We experience them. We can study them. We can actually create new technologies as a result of our understanding of the forces of nature. And if consciousness is real, if spirit is real, if divinity is real, then we shouldn't have to rely on belief, but on understanding and insight and experience. And that was Gautama's search. So he goes out and he becomes a chela, which means a disciple of many gurus. And he tries a guru, one guru after another. Some gurus who teach him yoga and meditation, other gurus who teach him breathing practices, other gurus who teach him asceticism, everything. And nothing works. And finally he starts to decide that he's going to practice the path of extreme asceticism, penance. And he's starving himself almost to the brink of death. And he's lying on the forest floor. And a young girl spots him and she tries to feed him. And he says, no. And then he asks her, he whispers and he asks her, what's your name? And the girl says, Sujata, which was the name of the girl he was in love with when he was a teenager. And he starts to weep for many reasons. One, the memory of his love. But two, he realizes that no matter what he did, he couldn't suppress his desire. And that's a big insight. Okay, because spiritual traditions say, give up desire. Well, have you ever tried to give up a desire? The more you give it up, the stronger it gets. In fact, if you suppress your desire and force that suppression, one day that'll express itself as a shadow energy in a pathological form. And he has that insight. And he surrenders. What he surrenders to in that moment is to the unknown. And he realizes that we live and breathe and experience life in the unknown all the time. We think it's the known, but the known is the past. It's already happened. Everything that we know has already happened. It's the past. We live and move and breathe into the unknown, pretending it's the known. And that little insight immediately grounds him in life-centered present moment awareness. And so through his own experience, he comes to describe the Four Noble Truths. First, that there is suffering in the world. Second, there are reasons for that suffering, which can be identified. Third, there's a way out. And fourth, this is the prescription. He's the original doctor. He identifies the disease, the symptoms, and offers the solution, the Eightfold Noble Path, which is, in his words, right thinking, right perception, or what he calls right view, right concentration, right living, right effort, right action, and most importantly, mindfulness. Mindfulness of what is. Mindfulness of what is happening. So, let's try that right now. Just become aware of your breathing. As the breath goes, and as the breath comes out. And as he becomes mindful of his breathing, he has an insight. Breathing arises, it subsides. It arises, it subsides. Then he has another insight. Thought arises, it subsides. Then he has another insight. Emotions arise, they subside. Then he has another insight. The perceptions of the world, they come and they go. Then he has another insight. Everything that has form, it also arises and subsides. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an ending. Whether it's your physical body or a piece of furniture. And he says everything that is of the nature of arising is also of the nature of subsiding. And from that comes his first dharma seal, as it's called. That everything in the relative, relative means everything that exists in space-time, is impermanent. That's his first insight. That the relative is impermanent. If it exists in space and time, it is impermanent. Then he has another insight. And all this, not through thinking, just by observing. Okay, just by being mindful. And the other insight is that the separate self does not exist. That everything is relationship. Your body is recycled earth and other bodies. You know, with every breath that we breathe in, and now I'm talking scientifically, every breath you breathe in, you take in 10 to the power of 22 atoms. With every breath you breathe out 10 to the power of 22 atoms. Then these atoms have their origin in every cell of your body. At the atomic level, we are all intimately sharing our organs with each other. So, my physical body is as much as your physical body. In fact, today we can do scientific studies that show that mathematically you can prove that right this moment you have in your physical body at least a million atoms that were once in the body of Christ. Or Buddha for that matter. Or Genghis Khan. Think of anyone who's existed. You have stuff in your body that was circulating there. So our bodies are recycled bodies. Right? He says, what about my breath? My breath is the recycling of this atmosphere. What about my circulation? It's the recycling of all the rivers and waters. What about my emotions? Well, we recycle our emotions as a result of relationships. They're not ours. We think they're ours, but they don't belong to us. What about our thoughts? Well, most of our thoughts are recycled information. It says, what about my personality? That must be me. There's no personality in the absence of relationship. It's the recycling of relationships. So then where's me? And he comes to a conclusion. He says, you know, if you have a soul, it's a reflection of all other souls. You can't be by yourself. So that's the second dharma seal. Just observing. And then he says that this impermanence in time and this non-separate self is the result of an interdependent co-arising of something that's happening at a deeper level. At a much deeper level. And that deep level is consciousness. But again, not through analysis, through insight. Through mindfulness. So right now, as you're listening to me, you're listening to me, right? So, as you're listening to me, just turn your attention to who's listening. So as you're listening to me, become aware of who's listening. And I hope you feel a presence. And if you do, that's your consciousness. Consciousness is the word he uses, but spirit means the same thing. So as you're listening to me, you turn your attention to who's listening. There's a spirit there. There's a consciousness there. It's not your mind, which might be saying, I wish I'd gone to the bathroom before he started or something. Okay? So he says there's a consciousness in which everything arises and then it subsides. In this consciousness, thoughts come and go. In this consciousness, emotions come and go. In this consciousness, the perceptions of the world come and go. In this consciousness, the molecules of the body come and go. Because once upon a time, you had a body of an infant or a baby or a teenager. You had different emotions, different mind, different personality. All that has been arising and subsiding and arising and subsiding. But the consciousness in which this comes and goes, it does, it's always there. And he has a brilliant insight. He says, hold on to this one because it's the only real part of you. And if you hold on to it, then it'll be your ticket to freedom. Because in this consciousness are infinite possibilities. In this consciousness is the interdependent co-arising of everything that's happening in the universe, what today we call synchronicity. In this consciousness is where you create, and your creativity is infinite. And in this consciousness, we are all co-creating each other. And he says, if you stay grounded here, if you shift your internal reference point here, then you'll suddenly feel eternal. Which I said, non-local, which is the experience I had when I decided that I wasn't going to throw my ashes in Oakley Golf Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. So today, many of our current scientists, they speak of what they call discontinuity. Discontinuity. And what they're saying is that even though the world appears to us to be continuous, it's actually a vibration that goes on and off. And somehow, this on-off vibration becomes the experience of the material world. So close your eyes for a second. Imagine a sunset over the mountains. Imagine a candle in a dark room. Imagine a red rose with a green stem. Now open your eyes. When I said, imagine a sunset, could you see a picture of a sunset over a mountain? Where's that picture? Do you think if I looked inside your brain, I'd see a picture of a sunset? No. So where is that picture? What would I see inside your brain, by the way? I would see a binary code of charges, like zeros and ones, a binary code of charges that goes across a cell membrane, that vibrates across a cell membrane. No picture. But you saw a picture, right? Where's the picture? Where's the picture that you saw? In consciousness. And where's that consciousness? It has no location in space-time. It has no location in space-time. In the ancient wisdom traditions in India, they called it the Akashic Field. Okay, now close your eyes and imagine the sound of a newborn baby crying. Hear it. Imagine a dog barking. Taste a strawberry. Lick a lemon. smell the locker room in your gym. Feel the soft skin of a newborn child. Feel the sensation of your hands touching the rough bark of a tree. Okay, so open your eyes. You had an experience, right? Some experience you had. But where's the sound that you heard? You think if I went inside your brain, I'd find some loudspeaker making that sound? Where's the taste, the smell, the textures that you experienced in your imagination right now? They're in consciousness. And that consciousness has no location in space-time. In your brain, there's a counterpart, there's a correlate, it's just a plus-minus code of charges. So all your subjective experience exists in consciousness. Okay, now look at me. What color is the shirt? Okay, some color. What color is this jacket? Okay. Pick any color. This young lady's blouse, orange. Now, what we see as orange is an experience in consciousness. Because what is orange on the level of physical reality? It's a colorless, massless frequency of electromagnetic radiation. And those photons are hitting my retina. The photons don't have orange in them. Okay, there's no orange in my eyes. There's no orange in the electrical current that goes to my brain. And there's no orange in the vibration of charges in my brain that goes on and off. So where's the orange? Where's the experience of the outside world? It's only in consciousness. How the brain translates a binary code of photons into the experience of a world out there is a very bizarre mystery. Because when I'm looking at you out there, there's something happening in the brain in here, and the brain in here has no direct experience of the outside world. The brain responds to things like pH, electrolytes, hormones, body temperature, and all that activity finally translates again into a binary code of photons, and that gives me the experience of you out there. But you don't exist out there. You exist only in my consciousness. And I exist only in your consciousness. And the consciousness in which you exist in me and I exist in you is the same consciousness. And he said, when we really experience that, then we feel love, we feel compassion, we feel kindness. Not as a moral injunction, because we should leave morality to the hypocrites. Okay? Now what H.G. Wells said, he said, morality is just jealousy with a halo. Okay. So, let us leave morality to the hypocrites. But when we have that experience that you exist in me, that the whole world exists in me, and that I exist in you and the whole world exists, and we are constantly allowing this world to arise and subside, he says, then we experience nirvana. Okay? And nirvana is that internal ecstasy in which love, compassion, understanding, insight, intuition, the power of intention, creativity, and choice-making spontaneously arise, and synchronicity, because everything is interdependently co-arising. So scientists say that even though the world appears to us to be continuous, it's actually going on and off. It's arising and subsiding. Same thing that the Buddha said. So photons arise and subside at the speed of light. Your body is also arising and subsiding. You don't have a two-year-old body anymore. It's gone. It arose, it subsided. Everything is a vibration. And it is a mystery how the vibration gets converted in our consciousness into the experience of the world. And that includes sight, sound, touch, taste, smell. All the experience of the world. So if I put my hand on your thigh and I don't move it, after a while you won't know it's there. But then if I move it again, you might say, what the heck are you trying to do? Today, scientists know exactly what's going on in the vibration. It's energy and information. Okay? So if I take a picture of yours with my little phone, I can then text it or email to somebody in China. And what goes from here to there is not a picture. What goes from here to there is a vibration that's going on and off. And what shows up in their phone in China is also not a picture. It's just a vibration that in your consciousness becomes the picture all over again. Quite mysterious, isn't it? Sir Arthur Eddington, who was one of the most brilliant scientists of the last century, he said, something unknown is doing we don't know what. And the more we try to understand it, the more bizarre it gets. So in the vibration, there's energy and information. But that's not the puzzle anymore. The big mystery is what's in between. So there's, you know, there's an on, then there's an off, then there's another on. What's in the discontinuity? What's between the vibrations? And so today, if you ask scientists, what's in the discontinuity? They'll say five things that they all agree on. The first thing they say is that in the discontinuity, there's no energy, there's no information, there's no space-time, and there are no objects. So, well, there's no energy, there's no information, there's no space-time, there are no objects. What's there? And the best answer scientists today can give you is there are infinite possibilities. The second thing that they say about this discontinuity is that everything is connected to everything else. Everything is correlated to everything else. What Buddha called interdependent co-arising. But they don't call it that. They call it non-local correlation, which means everything is instantly synchronized and correlated with everything else. And even though we see things happening one at a time, in the deeper domain, everything is happening all at once, and everything is correlated with everything else, especially in living organisms or in nature or biological organisms. The human body, for example, has 100 trillion cells. Each cell does 100,000 things per second. 100 trillion is more than all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. How does it do that? How does a human body think thoughts, play a piano, kill germs, remove toxins, and make a baby all at the same time? And while your body is doing that, it is tracking the movement of stars and planets because your biological rhythms are the symphony of the whole universe. That's why we call it the universe. One song, one symphony. So we are part of that symphony. Buddha called it interdependent co-arising. Scientists call it non-local correlation. The third thing that scientists all agree upon that's happening in the discontinuity, they say there's a proliferation of uncertainty. First described by a scientist called Heisenberg. And when he described this first time and he mentioned it to Einstein, Einstein made the famous remark, I don't believe that God would play dice with the universe. Well, Stephen Hawking recently said that God not only plays dice with the universe, God throws the dice where you will not find it. So this part of the universe, there's complete uncertainty. It proliferates with uncertainty. The fourth attribute that everybody agrees on is that there are quantum leaps of creativity. Quantum leap, I think you know what a quantum leap is, when a subatomic particle moves from one place to another place without going through the space in between. So it's here, it's there, in between was nowhere. Not only does it move from here to here without going from here to here, but it does so instantly without any time involved. Again, bizarre. If you watch that science fiction program, Star Trek, it's when the captain says, "Beam me up, Scotty." Scotty presses the button, and the captain disappears here, shows up somewhere else. And today, many scientists are saying this is nature's creativity. You cannot program it into a computer, because computers are based on algorithms. And nature's creativity and your creativity, my creativity, it comes from the discontinuity. It's unpredictable. And the fifth attribute that all scientists also agree on is something called the observer effect. And it was first described by a great scientist called John Wheeler, who was a protege and a student and a colleague later of Albert Einstein. And John Wheeler said, "The physical universe does not exist unless there's a conscious being looking at it." Which means if you and I didn't exist, or some conscious being didn't exist, the universe would just remain vibrations. A radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup. The magic is in our consciousness that we convert the soup into the experience of the world. And the reason I've spent so much time describing these scientific insights of the discontinuities that a man whom we now call the Buddha had these insights 2,500 years ago. That consciousness is not a thing, but the possibility for things. That consciousness interdependently gives rise to both the observer and the observed. That consciousness co-creates with that mystery that some of us call God. That consciousness proliferates in uncertainty, and from that uncertainty it creates over and over again. Unpredictability is the fertile ground of creativity, because the unknown is where creativity occurs, not in the known. If you're certain about everything, where's the creative process? 2,500 years ago. That was his enlightenment. That was his journey. And the beauty of it was, he said, to be Buddha is to be awake. So when he was dying, his favorite disciple, Ananda, said, "Who are you? Are you God? Are you a Messiah? Are you a messenger? Are you a prophet?" He said, "No." He says, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm awake." That's it. To be fully awake in your own consciousness is to be fully grounded in that field of possibilities in which the whole universe arises and the whole universe subsides. And that field of possibilities is our own self, which he calls the non-self, interestingly enough. Okay, because he says it can't exist by itself. Okay. So he says there are two kinds of truth. The relative truth is, this is, what is this? Podium, and I am a person. That's the relative truth. But the absolute truth, this is a tree, this is an ecosystem, this is the sunshine and the earth and the water and the wind and the air and the infinite void and the whole universe pretending to be a podium. And me? I am that consciousness in which I create this and also the one who's observing this. And if I ground myself there, I can create again and again and again. So, I hope you'll enjoy the story. You know, a lot of people tell me that they find my stuff a little difficult. And so I said, if I tell a story, maybe it won't be so difficult. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 21st, 2007.